It's time for Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chad Lincoln. You're listening to Let's Talk Money with Jim Place and Jamie O'Donnell. 267-1023 is our number. We start on market day. Dow Jones average sits at 38,895 points, down 77. S&P at 5,073, up 5 points. Jim, how are you doing today?
I am doing well, sir. Trying to keep an eye on some strange weather developing here. It is as high as it's going to get all day long right now, and now it's going to start dropping down into the 40s, down into the low 30s before this night is over.
So it is going to drop like a rock over the course of the next 4 hours.
That's exactly what's going to happen. Yes, very good observation. I'm doing well, thanks, and I hope that you are.
I appreciate it, Jim. With me this afternoon, Laura McKinney, Nick Nestor from Shambliss. Bonner, Stoffel, they all kind of say Shambliss now, don't they, really? Guys, how are y'all doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Very good. How about yourself, Laura?
Very good. Thank you.
Now, Laura, you were raised in Cleveland, Tennessee, weren't you?
Yes. Born and raised Cleveland, Tennessee.
Went to Vanderbilt, then went to Spain and taught English for 3 or 4 years, and then went to Harvard Law School.
Yes. I had a kind of winding journey to before I became an attorney. But.
And then old Nick, he's like, all the rest of us went to Tennessee, didn't you?
That's exactly
that law
right.
School and somehow passed the bar, right?
Yeah, don't know how it happened, but thankfully it did.
Now, how long were you in New York?
So that's where I started my legal career. I practiced at a big law firm there for about 8 years before coming to Chambliss about 8 years ago.
So. Okay. All right, I want to start off on a subject that you all recommend that we get with, and it's not going to pertain to everybody out there, but it's new requirements relative to the Corporate Transparency Act. First off, in layman terms, let's explain what this is and who's impacted by it.
So the Corporate Transparency Act is a new law that went into effect on January 1st of this year. And it requires really any type of business entity, an LLC, a corporation, a limited partnership, to report information about its beneficial owners, who are the individuals that own and control the entity.
Why is that different than what it used to be?
So this is at the federal government level, and our federal government has not had these type of comprehensive reporting requirements in place before. This is under an agency called the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. That's a division of the Treasury Department. And so this is an effort by the United States to kind of bring itself more in line with Europe and some other parts of the world to combat financial crimes such as money laundering, terrorism financing, things like that.
And currently, we don't have to necessarily report who owned, or excuse me, before this law, there was no requirement to report the owners of an LLC or a limited partnership or anything like that.
Why, as a member of an LLC, when I hear all this, do I just think pain in the ass?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not a terrorist. I'm not cheating the United States government. I'm paying my taxes. It just sounds like another form for 99.9% of us and another requirement that heretofore we did not have.
Exactly right. And, you know, I think the biggest struggle here is we hear Corporate Transparency Act, and when I hear that, I think that is something that would apply to maybe large publicly traded company, you know, businesses. But this applies to, that's not who this applies to. It applies to
the opposite.
It's exactly the opposite.
It's basically small to mid-sized business owners.
Or it's, if I have a vacation house and I have it in an LLC, it's that. Or if I have my brokerage account in an LLC, it's that. So it's going to have a much further reaching impact.
So what are they really asking us to do? And who's doing this? Is this something done by my accountant?
For the most part, what we've seen is the accounting firms have been informing their clients about it, but not actually taking on the responsibility for handling the filing.
What is it I'm supposed to do as a business owner in an LLC?
So you can talk to your attorney, but depending on the complexity of your business structure, it is something that someone who, you know, a single owner of an LLC can easily go to the website, the reporting website, FinCEN.gov, and put in the information. There's no fee. So it's the process itself is not too complicated. Where it gets tricky is working with business owners that have very complicated ownership structures and interest in a lot of different LLCs or LPs and kind of
where they're having to literally report on every one of those.
Yes.
Is that each one of those an individual report? Is it all just listing?
Yes.
Every one of them's individual.
It's each individual. And, you know, so there's two prongs to who you must report information on. The first are just those who own, you know, more than 25% of the business. And that in a lot of cases is straightforward. If you have some sort of weird equity option grants, that adds complexity, but that's not as common. But the second group of people are those who substantially control the entity. And that's where, in a lot of cases, the legal analysis gets a lot more complicated. For example, if you have a trust that may be part of that LLC, that could be three or four people, the trustee, the beneficiaries.
That all have to report.
Exactly.
And might not even be aware that they have to report.
Mm-hmm. And it's the entity's obligation, to be clear, to report. But for an entity to be able to report, they need information from the people.
And all I'm really telling them is, yes, I'm an owner, or yes, I'm a participant, or yes, I've got a level of control.
Mm-hmm.
They're just looking for notification.
And then a copy of your driver's license and your social.
That's not a lot different than in our industry. So in essence, we're getting a copy of the driver's license, and that has to do with the Patriot Act, terrorism, and where the money came from.
With the Know Your Customer requirements that banks, are the information that banks require to open bank accounts.
All right. Who are we going to here? Hey, Julie, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question is, I just had this conversation with my tax accountant last night in conjunction with my estate attorney about this issue. And we're trying to figure out for a property whether to build a joint venture, LLC, partnership, or S-Corp. And I'm not sure I know the difference and how that will affect this.
So all of the joint venture, so an LLC and an S-Corp would both give you limited liability protection if you put the property in that entity. Which of those you choose really is probably going to be driven by tax concerns.
That's more of a tax decision on if you want to use an LLC or an S corporation. And, you know, most times, at least in Tennessee, even if you decide to be an S corporation, you'll organize as an LLC and you'll make a specific election with the IRS to change the tax treatment from either a disregarded entity if it's only one owner, or from a partnership if it's two owners, two or more, to elect to be treated as an S corporation. And there's pros and cons to both. And that's really a fact dependent analysis on which to do there.
And for purposes of the...
And that may be why she brought the whole thing up.
Corporate Transparency Act that we were talking about, all of those would be treated the same. You would have to make the same reporting of the beneficial ownership for each of those entities.
Okay. So I've been reporting for the past 4 years to do with the property without any kind of LLC, partnership, corporation, whatever. The co-owner, a brother, we were inheritors of a property, has not been, and I'm trying to protect myself, and the tax accountant is, I think wisely, she's leading me toward the partnership or S-Corp, because I need to make sure I'm as removed as possible.
I think, Julie, you're getting good advice. Mm-hmm. I mean, from a liability standpoint, I think it's crossing the T's and dotting the I's. I think which direction you go, as they said, is really going to be more dependent. If someone calls me, and number one is I'm not going to offer the advice, I'm going to say, you need to talk to so-and-so, because I'm not necessarily qualified, although I might have a pretty darn good idea as to what entity they ought to go to. It is always going to be fact-specific and normally tax-specific, and there always tends to be a plus and minus to each one of them. It's just one, which one comes closer to fitting what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. I just don't ever want to be caught where, and I think she is leading me very correctly, to remove myself from any liability that he may incur, the co-owner or the co-inheritor. I just never want to be attached to anything that he does or does not do. So I think she is leading me correctly based on what I've heard y'all say.
All right. Thanks, Julie. We appreciate the comments. 267-1023. Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money on Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. With me this afternoon, Laura McKinney, Nick Nestor with Shameless, Bonner, and Stoffel. Let's talk for a second, because both of you, you've got some carryover in what you do from an expertise standpoint. Laura, you mentioned before the show that there are just a lot more mergers and acquisitions than there has been in the past, and that you find yourself working more on the sales side than the buy side. What's going on?
So we have a lot of clients, longstanding clients, who have, you know, had a very successful business, either in the family or larger business, for one or more generations, that often get to the point where they're looking for an exit strategy. Either because the next generation's not going to be stepping in, or, you know, they don't have someone that they can transfer that business to. So we, you know, we work with Nick and his group on succession planning and making sure that we have a strategic path forward.
Am I coming to you before I find a buyer? Am I coming to you to prep my company for sale?
Yes, I think maybe more so Nick than me, because in our estate group, I think, well, actually both of us, I think I would talk to you about some good kind of corporate practices, that good corporate housekeeping that you could do to sort of get your
kind of ducks in a row to
exactly get everything in order, so that when a buyer comes in and starts doing diligence, you're not caught off guard for the kinds of things
by not being able to produce the material you need to produce for someone to evaluate.
Exactly.
What the price of your business should be.
Exactly. And then I think on the other hand, you'd want to talk to, you know, Nick or someone in our estates group about, you know, what your plan looks like, both for structuring the sale of the business and how that's going to impact your tax and estate going forward. And
you know what's kind of interesting about that is it's not uncommon to see a business owner spend their entire life trying to show they made less. And then it absolutely bites them in the butt when they're trying to sell their business for the most amount of money, because all the paperwork says you only made X.
Yep.
I mean, there's where you begin that transition. I mean, I hate to say it, but there's almost a point in time, 4 or 5 years from going, I'm going to sell. I may actually want to show my business as being more profitable, because of the difference between, obviously, the difference between tax profit and real profit. I get that. But in essence, a lot of these deals get made on what the tax return says, don't they?
Mm-hmm. That's true. But I guess a lot of, especially for some of the larger businesses, they do end up oftentimes working with a financial advisor, an investment bank, a broker, to kind of do those pro forma financial statements to kind of back out all of the expenses that they may have put on the business.
You know, that's really interesting, because that could be done by a business broker.
Mm-hmm.
It could be done by a financial advisor, and it could be done by your accountants if they're qualified to do it. And indirectly, it could be done by a law firm that always has hidden accountants somewhere that nobody else knows about. Because they don't want to appear to be in the business of accounting, because they get a lot of referrals from accountants. I get that.
Yeah.
But there are, you almost have to have, like Nick, in your business, if you don't understand taxation, you can't be an estate attorney.
No,
you're not going to be a good qualified one. I know that.
That's exactly right. I mean, tax touches everything we do, and whether it, you know, from the income tax side with clients who are more charitably inclined, or basis issues related to the step up, or, you know, foregoing that on some gifted assets to the estate and gift tax and generation skipping tax. All of those are just so intertwined with the estate planning side of things.
You know, and the truth is, Laura, I mean, the kind of sale we're going to structure is tax-driven.
Of course.
Are we doing an asset sale? Are we doing a capital stock sale? Are we going to be an employee of the firm for the next 2 years or 5 years during the transition period? Because every bit of that ends up breaking down in some way, shape, or form to dollars and cents.
That's exactly right.
And what are you agreeing to do? And am I selling 28 tractors, or is 50% of my business goodwill?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that get structured? So, I mean, and I'm guessing a significant majority of the time, the person that's selling their business has never been involved in one of these transactions in their entire life. And they are historically only going to be involved in one. That's not a lot different, Nick, than in your business, where, you know, who comes to you a lot of the times is a person that got stuck being the executor or the trustee one time, and now they know when they ask them a second time, I ain't doing this on my own.
That's a very common comment I get from clients is, you know, I was the executor, I was the trustee, or I saw, you know, XYZ's person's estate be administered. It was a nightmare. It was a ton of work. I want to make this simple. I don't want that to happen to my
And what's weird is I don't know that you ever make it simple.
No.
But you can make it very, very doable. But if you're going to be the executor, you're going to be the trustee, you better step up, cross the T's and dot the I's. And if you're not familiar with that role, you better get help.
You're going to be way
better off if you do.
That's it. And, you know, the probate around here isn't terrible. In some states it can really be bad. But if you plan for it properly, it's not the end of the world. But you need help in a lot of cases. Unless you know what you're doing, you can easily get lost and end up in a situation where it just becomes a much bigger nightmare than it needs to be.
Well, I mean, I would think in both your cases, depending on what aspect of law that you all are practicing, your customers and or clients, to the extent that they ever get hurt, get beat on what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people that have run successful businesses out there are smart enough, if they have a full understanding of the facts, more often than not, they're going to make good decisions. Mm-hmm. It's where good people make bad decisions because they do not have all the information they need, because you guys are in the business of looking at train wrecks. You've seen 100 train wrecks. There's no time I've ever sat down with Dana Perry on the estate planning side, and whereas Dana doesn't immediately look, she listened to what they've got to say. In the back of her mind, she's always thinking, what could possibly go wrong? And if it does, where do we stand?
Yep.
Because if it goes right, there's no big need for a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when it doesn't go right. And someone tells me the same thing about surgeons. Is that you want to know the difference between a good one and a bad one? You get into the middle of the procedure and they have to change course.
Yeah.
Then the anesthetist or the nurse, the surgical nurse, can tell you who's good and who's not.
Well, and, you know, one place I see that kind of touches both of our worlds, where people make, I don't know if bad decisions the right term, they act without all the facts, is on the estate and tax planning side, once a letter of intent is signed to sell your business, our hands are tied in 99% of the things we can do, or at least it takes a lot of strategies off the table. And I know it never fails that we'll have a handful of clients each year who sign the letter, send it back, and then call us and they're like, hey, we've signed this, we're going to sell our business, what do we need to do? And that may or may not have been in their best interest.
Yeah. If at all possible, you know, we like to get involved in the process before any kind of letter of intent is signed, because oftentimes the letter of intent outlines the structure of the transaction, obviously the price and the other material terms. So it's always helpful for us to be able to provide advice on those before.
Laura, when you start talking about making the sale of a business, one of the things we got to figure out is what are we really selling?
Yes.
I mean, it does depend upon whether we're selling widgets or whether we're manufacturing widgets or whether it's a law firm or an accounting firm mm-hmm. or something that's actually going to be sold that's mainly intellectual capital mm-hmm. but not really assets.
Right.
So in essence, the potential structure of a merger, an acquisition, a sale, a purchase, whatever label you want to put in it, is really going to be very, very dependent on exactly what you're buying.
That's exactly right. It's very dependent on the type of business. Oftentimes, if there are a lot of hard assets or a lot of contracts as well, if you do an asset purchase, you're going to have to, you may have, you know, a lot of work actually transferring over all of those assets, getting consent to assign all of the contracts, getting new, you know, licenses or permits transferred. So sometimes in that situation, a stock purchase, you know, buying the entire company itself can be more efficient.
Well, I mean, you can have something as straightforward as, look, I have a contract to deliver X amount of goods to this company for the next 3 years. So the question becomes immediately, if I sell this company, is that contract good for the new owner?
Exactly. Right.
You know, I mean, so in essence, that's another scenario where what you think you're purchasing, you may or may not be purchasing.
Exactly.
And then we start talking about non-competes.
Right.
Relative to who can compete. Can, you know, do I want to buy a business from Nick and then 6 months later, Nick's in business stealing the clients that I just paid him for?
Right.
Mm-hmm. No. All of it comes to play.
Yes.
And if it could go wrong and it might go wrong, you're there to make sure it doesn't go wrong. Or that the people you represent have legal claim mm-hmm. relative to some level of malfeasance by the other individual.
And another consideration I've seen pick up more recently, and it may just be through what I'm seeing, but the analysis of if the seller wants to take some rollover equity position in the buyer, do they just want, you know, full cash and to walk away from business, or do they want to keep a, you know, a portion of those sales proceeds and rolled over equity that is dependent on how the new buyer operates the business?
Are they interested in transitioning out of a business over a 3 to 5 year period mm-hmm. of time with X amount of equity put up front and they go on? Or is the new buyer a venture capital firm that's going to keep them there 12 months, fires them after 2 months out there, then runs the company into the ground like they damn usually do?
Yep.
267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money on Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back for Let's Talk Money, 267-1023. Laura, I got a question for you. Intellectual property. Non-competes.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do in that world? What's going to get? I mean, the whole idea of a non-compete's gotten less attractive to the court systems.
That's right.
You know, where you're really impinging upon someone else's ability to do business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming there's different types of non-competes out there, depending on whether they're an employee or whether they're a partner.
Right. I mean, we still very typically see in connection with any sale of a business, a 5-year non-compete for the owners that are selling that business. And I think that is probably a little easier to enforce than some of the non-competes that you see in the employee context. For employees and for former business owners, I think most businesses are seeing more value these days in non-solicit covenants, where the employee is restricted from going after the customers of the business for a certain period of time after they no longer work there. And then those are a little easier to enforce than a very broad non-compete that might.
And that's real more the solicitation of the client base
right.
than it is prohibiting someone else from being inside that industry.
Exactly.
Or business.
You can go work in the industry. We don't want to stop you from, you know, feeding your family, but just please don't call
customers. If we've compensated you for yes. our customers, then, you know, and particularly if you've paid someone for it.
Right.
as versus if they're just a W-2 employee out there and they happen to work for you and you kind of on the front end got them to sign a non-compete, mm-hmm. and the judge may look at that and go, why was this even here?
Right. Yeah. The overreach with, you know, having even low-level employees sign non-competes, I think, has kind of swung the pendulum back to making those harder to enforce.
Is there talk to me a little bit about types of sales, the structure of the sale of a business,
mm-hmm.
And you may define the difference between an asset purchase,
right,
versus where you have an enormous amount of goodwill. What are the most favorable ways to look at this kind of stuff?
In broad strokes, oftentimes a buyer is going to prefer an asset purchase because they can minimize taking on any trailing liabilities from the business. So they'll want to take the assets out of the entity, put them into a new entity, and hit the ground running from there. While on the sell side, it's often more favorable for a seller to sell the actual stock or equity of their business.
Because that's going to create more of a capital gain type of transaction.
Exactly.
And not necessarily deductible from the standpoint of the buyer.
Mm-hmm. And particularly if there's a bunch of hard assets that you've depreciated in the business, because then you go from the capital gain treatment to the ordinary income recapture. And that can very much increase the tax liability, where if you're just sitting here saying, oh, we're selling the business, everything's going to be taxed at, call it 20%. And then you have a large amount of recapture there. That really shifts those numbers.
And when you say recapture, what you're really saying is I have a piece of equipment out there. I have been depreciating that equipment. And that equipment I bought for $100,000. It's now worth $40,000, but I'm carrying it on my books at $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have depreciated the asset for a 10 or 15-year period of time. When I sell, my cost basis is no longer 50 or 100. My cost basis is the 10, which is my depreciated value of it. Now I'm picking up a capital gain on an $80,000 or $90,000 event or whatever the case would be.
Yeah, and it's ordinary income back
yes.
to the initial basis. So that's where you go from paying, call it 20% to 40%. And that can have a huge hit. And buyers prefer the asset sale is they then take a fair market value basis in that property.
Based on its value the day you bought it.
Yes. And then they
not
can depreciate
value.
It, of course. Then they can depreciate it, which is just more beneficial to them.
I hear a lot of people bitch about recapture. Did they not know it on the front end when they were depreciating the property or depreciating whatever it was going to be, that when if they depreciated it down to zero and they sold it for something, they were going to owe ordinary income tax because their basis has changed because of that depreciation schedule?
I think it's like any time you have to pay tax, even if you know it's coming, it hurts when you have to do it. I mean, I think that's really the brunt of it. And where you see that, I think, hurt the most is in the real estate world, on the commercial real estate side.
Are either one of you ever involved in 1031 exchanges?
Occasionally I'll work on them.
That can be kind of slick too, can't it?
Mm-hmm. That's a very powerful technique if you're looking to pass that property down to the next generation, because you just keep doing the 1031, never really realizing any income tax, any gain from the sale of the property. And then when your children inherit the property, they've got a stepped up basis and could sell it the very next day and not have any tax on that sale.
Under the assumption that it wasn't gifted to those children while the parent was still alive. That understanding, when we start talking about estate planning structure out there, boy, that's one that gets a lot of people. They just think, well, I'll just clear it up right now. I'll go ahead and leave it to them right now. When you leave it to them right now, you have left them your original cost basis regardless.
That's exactly right. And, where we see that a lot is because on, financial accounts, we can put a beneficiary on them and easily avoid probate. Where we see the problems
Yeah, you're talking about TOD, POD,
right,
or whatever the case
would
be.
Of course. But on, you know, mom's house, who wants to leave it to her only son, we can't. That's going to have to go through probate unless it's in a trust.
Well, the rub is always going to be an individual out there that's saying, well, I want to get the house out of my name to qualify for Medicaid somewhere down the line. I have to gift it 5 years ahead of time. But I didn't think about the fact that we bought this homestead in 1962. It's got a $900,000 gain. Yeah, I saved $5,000 Medicaid taxes and cost my kid $300,000 inheritance tax because they didn't know the difference.
That's it. It's really just a simple numbers game. I mean, when we're looking at the step-up basis versus the estate tax, that's a 20% rate, the capital gain rate, compared to a 40% estate tax rate. So that those numbers are usually pretty easy to determine. But to your point on the Medicaid and how much are we going to have to pay for care, how much is the government going to come back and take from my estate, that can get a lot more complex.
And Lawrence, no really difference in the not really completely different in the business transaction and the sale of the business. Mm-hmm. In essence, if I'm going to do a certain type of sale, mm-hmm. I'm going to want 10% more because it's going to cost me 10% more in taxes.
Right.
What we're looking at here of a negotiation on a buy sell side is pretty straightforward. What do you know? Everybody wants to know at the end of the day, after it's all said and done and all the taxes are paid, what did I end up with? The buyer wants to know that, and the seller wants to know that. And in the perfect world, neither one of them is surprised at the other end.
Exactly.
They understand. They have accepted that, yeah, I'm going to get this sale. I'm going to get it treated this way, but I'm going to sell it for 5% less, or I'm going to sell it for 10% mm-hmm. more. And in essence, everybody knows what it is. They're honest to goodness looking at the bottom line. Because where somebody gets pissed is they get to the end, and they got a big surprise that they didn't know about.
That's exactly right.
Go ahead. And that was something what I was kind of hinting at earlier when I said we have client or don't sign the letter of intent because you may not know what you're looking at. You may have a $5 million offer there for your business and you think that's fair, but you don't realize that it's structured as an asset sale and you've depreciated all your assets. And at the end of the day, you're paying, you know, I don't know, an effective tax rate of 35% and you're 15% less.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, $5 million becomes 3.8 instead of 4.4, and you go, whoa, 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 what happened? Well, you signed that letter of intent without getting good legal guidance. 267-1023, Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money on Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. Nick Nestor, Laura McKinney with me this afternoon from Shambliss, Bonner & Stouffville of the phone lines. Hey, Doug, how are you?
Hello there. Are you talking to me?
Yes, we are.
Okay. My parents put their home in a warranty deed retaining a life estate for their children. And can you tell me, does that affect the tax basis upon inheritance? Or how it affects the tax base?
Generally, it will. Because the way that structure works is the people who have received the remainder interest, which is, I would guess, you become the owner of
the sale's been made.
Yeah, the transfer's been made. You are the owner of the property. However, someone else has a right to use that property based on a time determined their lifetime.
But what you've really asked there, Doug, is have I also inherited their cost basis? I believe the answer is generally yes.
Generally, yes. I mean, there's ways it can be structured to preserve the step up in basis, but usually if it's just a life estate, the answer is going to be no. But it with life estates and retained life estates, that becomes highly technical, and there are opportunities to preserve that.
What would that process look like? Can we turn the house back over to them to cancel this out? Or I know they did it to avoid potential assets if they had to go in for into retired living or something. I know that's why they did it. But to avoid, I guess, the income limits or asset limits you get into when
And, as to whether it can be undone, yes, but really with everything, there's a ton of but maybe not. For example, if I give something to my parents and then they pass away within a year and I inherit it back, the IRS has said, nope, you don't get a step up in basis in that case. And there are certain other considerations that would need to be looked at before transferring it. For example, there is a federal gift tax out there, and do we need to file a gift tax return?
If you were to have an entity, let's say in this particular case, his parents gifted it back to him. If that gift was more than that $17,000 or $34,000 in a couple, they would have an obligation to report that. It wouldn't necessarily create a taxable event. It would just go against their total exemption. So if your gain is going to be big enough, Doug, then you probably want to call these people and let's look at what your options are. If the gain isn't that big, you may just let it go and not be too concerned about it.
Yeah, right now it's going to be split between five children, and it's maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars.
You know, and then you almost got to, I mean, this is the layman version of me saying this. I just got to know how much dog do I have in that hunt? Does it make that much difference, and is it a big enough deal?
Well, and we can't always let the tax tail wag the dog. You know, if this is something that may disqualify benefits that very well could exceed those numbers, then it's like, okay, what's more important here? And we really need to get refocused on what's the main goal. And sometimes achieving the main goal isn't going to put us in the best tax situation or isn't going to be the most simplest option, but it will, it achieves that goal. And that's why it's always hard to say, you know, does this make sense? Should we do this? Should we unwind it? Because yeah, it may be better from the income tax side, but what does that do from the benefit side? And what does that do in the other aspects?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Thanks, Doug. We appreciate your comments. You know, in essence, when you look at all of these different potential choices that you've got out there, understand that every single one of them have different repercussions. And you're trying to project. I had we're not going to have time to do it now, but an individual that inherited farm property that became an exit ramp on I-75, and where they were gifted something that they perceived to be worth $30,000, it was worth $2 million, and they ended up with a capital gains tax on $1,970,000 that could have been completely avoided simply by leaving it to them in the will. And that, in essence, that's when we start talking about options, that's what we're talking about. Guys, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you for having us.
Dave Ramsey, coming up right now, The Ramsey Show from 1 to 3, 3 to 7, Sport Talk. Y'all have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.